This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen. As a native Floridian, Carl Hiaasen knows his hurricanes. He's covered them for the Miami Herald, where he worked as a reporter and is now a columnist. Back in 1987, he outraged Miami's mayor for saying that there was nothing wrong with South Florida that a Force 5 hurricane couldn't fix. The mayor asked him to apologize. Hiaasen declined. All of Hiaasen's novels reflect his concerns about the survival of Florida's delicate and storm-prone environment, overrun with theme parks, malls, superhighways, and shoddily built housing developments. His latest novel, Stormy Weather, is about the scam artists and corrupt construction and insurance companies that take advantage of hurricane victims. Hiaasen said that much of the novel was pulled right out of the headlines, including this episode.
Among the stream of outlaws who raced south in the feverish hours following the hurricane was a man named Gil Peck. His plan was to pass himself off as an experienced mason, steal what he could in the way of advance deposits, then haul ass back to Alabama. The scam had worked flawlessly against victims of Hurricane Hugo in South Carolina, and Gil Peck was confident it would work in Miami, too. He arrived in a 4-ton flatbed carrying a small but authentic-looking load of red bricks, which he'd ripped off from an unguarded construction site in Mobile, a new cancer wing for a pediatric hospital. Gil Peck had caught the festive groundbreaking on TV. That afternoon, he'd backed up the flatbed, helped himself to the bricks, and driven nonstop to South Florida. So far, business was booming. Gil Peck had collected almost $2,600 in cash from half a dozen desperate homeowners, all of whom expected him to return the following Saturday morning with his truckload of bricks. By then, of course, Gil Peck would be northbound and gone. By day, he worked the hustle. By night, he scavenged hurricane debris. The big flatbed conveyed an air of authority, and no one questioned its presence. Even after curfew, the National Guardsmen waved him through the flashing barricades. Many valuables had survived the storm's thrashing, and Gil Peck became an expert at mining the rubble. An inventory of his 2-day bounty included a bagel toaster, a Stairmaster, a silver tea set, 3 off-brand assault rifles, a Panasonic cellular telephone, 2 pairs of men's golf spikes, a waterproof kilogram package of hashish, a brass chandelier, a scuba tank, a gold-class ring from the University of Miami, a set of police handcuffs, a collection of rare Finnish pornography, a Michael Jackson hand puppet, an unopened bottle of 100-milligram Darvocets, a box set of Willie Nelson albums, a Loomis fly rod, a birdcage, and 21 pairs of women's bikini-style panties. Exploring the demolished remains of a mobile home park, Gil Peck was a happy fellow. There was a bounce to his step as he followed the yellow beam of the flashlight from one ruin to another. Thanks to the National Guard, the Highway Patrol, and the Dade County Police, Gil Peck was completely alone and unmolested in the summer night, free to plunder. And what he spied in the middle of a shuffleboard court made his greedy heart flutter with joy. A jumbo TV dish. The hurricane undoubtedly had uprooted it from some millionaire's estate and tossed it here for Gil Peck to salvage. With the flashlight, he traced the outer parabola and found one small dent. Otherwise, the 8-foot satellite receiver was in top condition. Gil Peck grinned and thought, man, I must be living right. A dish that big was worth a couple grand easy. Gil Peck thought it might fit nicely in his own backyard, behind the chicken coops. He envisioned free HBO for the rest of his natural life.
And that's Carl Hiaasen reading from his latest novel. It's called Stormy Weather. So as a journalist and as someone who has covered hurricanes in South Florida, how many Gil Pecks move in on the aftermath of a hurricane?
Well, when I was a kid and these things happened, I don't remember the sort of a wave, the assault wave of this kind of scoundrel that we had after Hurricane Andrew. And certainly the folks in South Carolina remember after Hugo and maybe Camille in the Gulf Coast states. I think it's sort of a new phenomenon. But when you had and part of it is the media. We had extensive, vast media coverage of that storm when Andrew hit in 92. And I think it inspired a lot of bad folks to try to come down and take advantage of the situation, and they did, sadly enough, along with all the volunteers and the church groups and the National Guard and the Red Cross. You had these kinds of maggots who sort of crawled their way down there and made a lot of money and got out before they could be arrested.
Well, how were they able to work so easily?
There was no law and order. I mean, after a storm, you had, in a space of 4 hours, 200,000 people put out of their homes, 125,000 homes destroyed. Partially or completely, everyone's attention was to the survivors and to restoring some sort of, communication, electricity, traffic lights. You can't imagine, unless you've been through a hurricane, there's just nothing. And so these people, all the efforts of the authorities were just traffic control. And if you're desperate and you're sitting there and your kids don't have a roof over their head and their water is dripping, mosquitoes, and somebody pulls up with a truck that says he's a roofer or a mason or whatever he is, and you just want to get some shelter and you're willing to pay them even though they're not licensed and even though they may have been a bartender the night before and just decided all of a sudden to put on roofs. And that happened a lot.
And would these maggots, as you describe them, would they target particular kinds of people, or was everyone in such desperate states?
There was no shortage of victims, you know. I mean, it was just an open season. And this is just one element. I mean, you had other kinds of folks down there, certainly appear in the novel as well, but the opportunism, it was at a fever pitch. It was a chance. Also, you got to realize that not just in the days after the storms, but in the weeks after the storm, you had millions of dollars in insurance money that was coming into South Florida. Millions and millions of dollars. A lot of these companies were paying off very quickly. It's good PR to do that after a storm. So you had people with some cash.
A lot of cash.
And FEMA was down there giving out checks to people. So you had folks walking around. Mm-hmm. And with that money, you know, it worked both ways. You had homeowners who thought they could sort of make a deal. They got $10,000 to put a new roof on. What if they could find someone to put the roof on for $5,000? And then the other $5,000 they could maybe put in a new swimming pool. And that happened a lot. And then they found out that whoever they hired to put on the roof may have been not exactly qualified. So, you know, it was an unbelievable time. There was an actual boom in terms of the economy, as bizarre as this sounds. In the months after the storm, there was a tremendous boom in South Florida's economy because all this insurance money. And after now, we're just getting almost 3 years later to the point where that money's spent. And we're sort of catching up with the rest of the country and sort of flattening out.
Well, who do you blame? And in your book, in your novel, there are many targets here. But who do you hold ultimately responsible for the kind of ripoffs that you both have written about as a journalist and as a novelist?
Well, the ripoffs being one part of it. I mean, you have to look at the whole political structure that says, you know, we live in a hurricane zone. And you can bet that there's going to be more hurricanes, and just as there have been. So what we're going to do is we're going to cram 5 million human beings into the Gold Coast of Florida in houses that are built like popsicle sticks, many of them, and we're just going to dare the hurricane to come. And when it comes, we're going to claim we didn't know it was going to be this bad. So the whole political – in Florida, the whole political engine is fueled with construction money, development money, bank money. Growth is the industry. We don't produce a lot of other things. And the problem is that it's nature's way of saying, all right, this is the price you pay. It would be like saying, I'm going to take my life savings and build a big house for my family on the San Andreas Fault because I don't think there's going to be any more earthquakes. I mean, that's about how bright it is.
Well, you have a character called Skink. He's actually an ex-governor turned renegade environmentalist. And he says hurricanes are an eviction notice from God. Is he the fictional Carl Hyacin?
Well, I mean, I think it's a true statement. He's appeared in just a couple other my novels. He's sort of a moral compass. And he's a radical. He's a radical something. I mean, he lives in the swamp and he eats roadkill, but he has nuggets of wisdom that he imparts. And he also says in the novel that a hurricane is a holy thing. And what he means by that is that if you can step back away from the wreckage that it causes to humanity and see sort of how it's – I mean, they've been hitting Florida for thousands of years. They're going to keep hitting Florida. It's an awesome natural force. I mean, it's an incredible thing to be a part of and to watch, and it has its own sort of fearsome beauty, and that was what he's talking about there, and that's why during the course of the storm he decides to strap himself to a bridge so he can watch it firsthand, which I wouldn't recommend, by the way.
Well, you've never done that, have you?
No.
But you blame politicians then for, I guess, saying to the rest of the world, hey, come on down, the water's great, the weather's fine, come in and live in Florida.
Not just that, but for caving into the special interests that say, please weaken our building code. You know, we had 30 years between Hurricane Donna and Hurricane Andrew where we didn't have a big storm. The result was that you had 70% to 80% of the people who got hit by Hurricane Andrew had never been through a hurricane. And apparently the people who built their homes had never been through a hurricane because a lot of them were incompetent, corruptly inspected, just shamefully unprepared for the storm. I don't blame the folks who lived there, but certainly the system over the years, the politicians had gradually weakened the building code to the point where for instance, nails were no longer required in shingles. They could staple shingles to the roofs. Now, if you've ever been in an 80-mile-an-hour wind, much less 160-mile-an-hour wind, you know how foolish and stupid that is. But that's how That's how lax the building codes had gotten. So, you know, the whole system is corrupt in that sense.
Well, you're talking about then flying debris. If things are literally not nailed down,
shrapnel. It was like every trailer, every mobile home, and in the path of that storm, thousands and every single one was destroyed. And you can say, well, okay, well, anyone who lives in a mobile home in a hurricane zone deserves what they get. Fine, but the problem is that those things become shrapnel, and they fly through the air like a beer can, and except they weigh a couple tons, and they destroy everything in their path. So a lot of the deaths and injuries came because of that. And you have to look at the larger good of the community, saying, isn't this not a very bright thing to have these big mobile home parks in a hurricane zone? And so there's all this movement. Yeah, you're right. We can't do this anymore. The destruction was, well, of course, they backed off a couple months after the storm. And we've got just as many as we had before, many of them put there by the federal government.
Is Florida on a collision course with Mother Nature? I guess always been that way.
Well, it's always been that way. And I think many parts of this country are. And I mean, if you look at what's happened to the eastern seaboard the last few years, even just hurricanes just nicking them, these are things to be reckoned with. And, you know, when Hurricane Hugo hit South Carolina, these barrier islands you built, they had these incredibly expensive homes that all blew away. Well, big surprise. I mean, who could possibly be surprised by that? Well, all the people that built the homes, you know, not the folks who lived there, but the builders, geez, we thought they'd withstand a storm. Well, they had no clue. They had no clue what they're dealing with. So in a lot of my novels, I mean, sort of a recurring theme is not just the sort of the recuperative power of nature, but sometimes sort of the vengeful power of nature. And you know, hurricanes are going to keep pounding. We used to, back in the 40s and 50s, it was not uncommon to have two or three storms every year hit the mainland of Florida. And back then, they were building homes that stood up because they just planned on the fact that they were going to get hit. And when you had a period that passed without the storms, of course, all those concerns sort of were forgotten, and we paid a terrible, terrible price in 1992.
Well, as you mentioned, storms have worked their way up at least the eastern seaboard and done a lot of damage. So I don't think Florida or Floridians are alone in this idea. It seems like a very American idea that we're in control of nature, damn it, and we're going to live precisely how we want, and we're going to then change nature, try to change nature so that it can accommodate our needs.
All right. Well, I mean, that's one thing that is always going to be true, is that you cannot alter the course of these storms. You can build better houses and you can build seawalls and all that, but you can't stop these storms from coming. And another phenomenon that isn't unique to Florida, but that we found after Andrew, and which is certainly a big part of the book, is this sort of macabre fascination with natural disasters that we have. We had people pouring into Dade County, tourists coming down to see the hurricane damage as if it were an extension of their Disney World vacation or their Sea World vacation, and one of the characters in the book comes
Max
down.
Max Lamb, right?
He changes course on his honeymoon, brings his new bride down there. They'd just been at Disney World, and he says, "Well, we're never going to get to see a hurricane. They're from New York, and let's go down and see what a hurricane did." And as insensitive and callous and as that sounds, that was happening to such an extent that on several occasions the police had to go on the air and beg people to please stay out of the hurricane zone unless they were rescue workers, because you had all these rubberneckers with their video cameras and their Nikons taking pictures, and people's lives are in ruins all around them, and they're taking pictures of overturned buses and wrecked houses like it's all part of the family album. And I found that behavior so appalling that I felt compelled to put Max in the book and to have Max dealt with in an appropriate way.
Well, not to give too much of the plot away, but Max is kidnapped by Skink. And that's the ex-governor turned renegade environmentalist. And at one point, and I wanted to ask you about your attitude towards tourists. At one point, Skink is kind of grilling him, like, do you really know what Florida is about?
Giving him a little quiz, yeah.
Yeah. Do you remember any parts of that quiz?
Well, he was asking.
We'll see if the audience can pass or fail it.
Well, he was asking him in particular if he knew who wrote The River of Grass, which is a book that all Floridians should know about. It's a book about the Everglades. And poor Max, sort of mistakenly guesses Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings.
Who wrote The Yearling.
Right. And for that, he's punished in a way that we won't go into. He should have said Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. But it's just sort of Skink's way of saying, you know, you come down here with your video camera and your package of tickets to Disney World, and you don't have a clue. You know, you're just here, and you think this is all for your amusement. And that's certainly, I think, a little episode that a lot of us, not just native Floridians, but folks who've lived there for years and years and who, you know, really care about the place sort of resent that attitude. But it's not just here. I mean, if you talk to folks in Montana and Wyoming, what they put up with the Yellowstone crowd.
Sure.
The people who've, in the Winnebagoes, bumper to bumper in Yellowstone, some of that's some of the most egregiously stupid behavior I've ever seen in my life.
What do you expect people to do on their summer vacation? Well, not come to Florida?
No, I mean, I'm just saying their behavior in general, certainly they could come, but it's the really sort of, you know, marginally brain-dead type of behavior that you have to question. I remember sitting in Yellowstone watching a woman with her children chasing a full-grown moose across a meadow trying to take a picture. I don't know if you know anything about what a moose can do, but most northerners certainly know that it can stomp you into sawdust in about 20 seconds. And she was determined to get a picture of her little girl with this full-grown moose. Mm. And rangers were screaming at her. I mean, this kind of behavior, if Darwin were alive, I think he would say, just let her go ahead and do that and let the herd be thinned, you know?
So to speak. But do you think, and maybe this is having interviewed you before on some of the other novels that you've written about Florida, but do you really want to sort of stop people at the border and see if...
No, I've been an advocate of a visa system for
okay.
a long time.
Well, how would it work?
Well, I mean, you certainly can come to Florida and enjoy Florida, and then after, you know, you give them 10 days, 2 weeks, and you leave. Goodbye. I mean, we just got too many people, and or else you balanced it. We have a certain amount of people leaving Florida now in steady numbers, but we have... Right now, our net gain a day is 770 people moving to Florida permanently every day. That's net. That's after deaths. That's after everything else, and which is a city about a new city the size of Tampa every single year coming to Florida. I don't know. I would love to know if Pennsylvania could absorb that kind of mass of humanity coming in.
Carl Hyacin is a columnist at the Miami Herald. His latest novel is called Stormy Weather. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Carl Hyacin is a columnist at the Miami Herald and the author of several novels that lampoon particular Florida institutions. A few years ago, he wrote Native Tongue, which took aim at the state's theme parks. When was the last time you went to Disney World? Or did you ever take your son when he was little?
When he was very little, yeah. We went there a couple times. And at the time, I was living and working in Central Florida, so I had to go there on some assignments. And you know, and when you have a little kid, it's a different experience. Mm-hmm. But when you have to cover it as a journalist, and you sort of, and there's some, believe me, everyone there is very nice. They're almost too nice. They're so nice, you want someone
to program nice.
I know, aren't
they?
And you want someone to throw something. You want to hear someone cuss. you want to see something go wrong. And I'll never forget what was raining one day, bitterly raining, and I had to go across the park to meet a celebrity for an interview. And the public relations person who was with me says, "Now I'm going to take you a secret way to this to the interview, but you've got to promise you won't write about this." I said, "What way?" And he goes, "We're going underground." And I'd never been in the catacombs under Disney World before. And you go down, literally like they move a dumpster and a trap door comes up, and you go down the trap door, and all of a sudden you're down there, and this is where all the garbage is moved, this is where all the food, and this is where all the characters have to hang out before they pop up on the streets. And so the first thing I see is like Mickey Mouse sitting down there. He's got his head off, and it's under his arm. You know, he's like drinking a Coke or smoking a cigarette or something. And it was kind of a neat, it was the first human view of the park that I'd had. And so I incorporated some of that into the novel. But I don't particularly enjoy the place because nothing spontaneous ever happens there. I mean, I tell people if you really want to go have some fun, go to like the Gatorland Zoo where they have like 6,000 alligators that half the time are eating each other. You know, I mean, you want to see what Florida. This the problem with Disney World is it could be anywhere. It could be in Mesa, Arizona.
So. Well, the thing about the Disney experience is that what you experience is what I experience. I mean, it is the kind of franchise fast food.
Well, you
of
know,
entertainment.
And when things happen spontaneously, it doesn't always go well there. A few years ago, I'd written about, the Herald had written about this at some length. They have some frontier land or frontier river, I don't know what. Anyway, it's a log camp. For some reason, some buzzards, wild turkey buzzards, of which we have many in Florida, started showing up. They had a tremendous attraction for the place. And these were not audio animated. These were real vultures. And the Disney people didn't know what to do because they didn't want any real like buzzards, because the buzzards were like looking at the caged birds with great lust and hunger. And so the Disney solution at the time was a couple of their folks kind of got out of hand and tried to settle the buzzard issue with baseball bats. And the animal rights folks got very upset, and Disney had to apologize to the buzzards, to the Buzzard Friends Society or whatever it was. And then, of course, they responded with this great public relations thing. Now they have a huge, you know, sort of, you know, endangered species program and everything else. But at the time, it was an illustration of they didn't really know how to cope with Florida nature. And so I wanted a theme park where nature intruded once in a while.
Carl Hiaasen is a columnist with the Miami Herald. His novel Striptease is being made into a movie starring Demi Moore and Burt Reynolds. His latest novel is called Stormy Weather. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.